Hey, everybody, it's Obi from the Obi and Axe Show with my co-host, Axe. We also have two very special guests and dear friends of mine today. We have the commanding officer of British Columbia for the RCMP, Jennifer Strachan, with us. And we also have the deputy chief of police for the Toronto Police with us as well. Thank you, Shauna Coxon and Jennifer Strachan, for being with us today.
Good afternoon.
It is a real pleasure to have you both with us. A big part of the Obi and Axe Show, as you know, as we've had, you know, many hours of discussion, our show is built to help people through adversity. And the main topics of the show are diversity, inclusion, mental health, addiction. And these are all major areas of concern and responsibility on for both of you. And I'm so happy that you're both with us today, because I'd love to get an inside look as to, you know, how these areas affect, you know, what you do on the daily, and also, you know, the future and how you see these different topics evolving and some of the change that might be. So I'm going to put the first question to you, Shauna. In terms of mental health, you know, how do you find, you know, it in the everyday for the officers dealing with mental health issues in the city? And what do you guys do to ensure that not only is the community protected, but the officers are protected as well?
Mental health is a huge issue. It's one of our most rising calls, meaning we go to more and more of them all the time. Yeah. We do 30,000 calls for mental health, if you can imagine.
Wow.
And we have mobile crisis intervention teams here in Toronto, and that is a police officer paired with a nurse. And both of them have specialized training in mental health, and they will go out and respond to these calls. The challenge is, of the 30,000 calls, we just don't have enough of those teams to go to all of them. And so you know, there's different models that exist out there, and there's lots of discussions happening right now in Toronto regarding how these kinds of calls should be dealt with. It's definitely a huge issue in the city of Toronto, as it is everywhere.
So the other question I had for you was, this isn't just a cut and dry area, that when it comes to mental health, if you get a call and it's already escalated to a point where a nurse or anybody would be in potential danger, whether that's physical, you know, could be even loss of life, how do the police then have to act? Because that gets forced kind of back onto the police, where we talked about it, you're liable if anything were to happen. So how do you kind of judge that? And what's the buffer there between where you can bring a nurse or when that's too dangerous? How does that get judged?
So even when we bring in the nurses, in terms of the MCIT teams, where it's a nurse paired with a police officer, they're always a secondary responder. And that's because we just need to get there first to figure out, is everybody safe? Are they okay? You know, if you have a situation where, you know, someone's, you know, potentially in danger, where there might be a weapon involved, this kind of thing, we need to get there and just make sure everyone is physically safe. Yeah. And then we can bring in the nurses with the police officers to assist with whatever the mental health issue is. And also to look at various types of resourcing in terms of getting them help. What I think is really important, though, to think about, and it's something that's happening right now, right across the country, is the discussion around, should police be involved in these calls at all? Should police be involved in mental health calls at all? Or is there a different model which would allow social workers, nurses, other types of agencies to come in and to deal with these calls?
Yeah, I think that's a great discussion, because, you know, I think from the public's point of view, the fact that, you know, that conversation is happening is very positive to hear that, you know, the police is really thinking about those issues, because it is something to talk about. We may not be sure if they are the correct people to take on that call at that right time. So I'm glad that we're talking about this.
And, you know, it's right. So Shauna, you do have the ability to bring in the nurses, and I want to roll this over to Jennifer. We also discussed this, Jen, that you, in a lot of cases, you don't have the opportunity to kind of work with nurses for a lot of these cases. So tell me about some of the positives and some of the struggles that you deal with for mental health on your end for the RCMP.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it shows the diversity across Canada, not just within, you know, different provinces, but up into the territories as well. And much like Toronto's best practice of mobile crisis intervention teams, where we have standing agreements with mental health practitioners, whether they be nurses, etc., that does exist in BC in places like Surrey, for example, Vancouver Police as well, and here in Surrey for the RCMP. For example, we have those agreements in our cell blocks as well. So if we bring a detained person in and they're struggling, we can access health practitioners to come in.
Okay.
So, but when we're talking about smaller communities wherein you know, 24/7, you don't have access to even health authority figures. You know, we often work with local mayor and council, whether it be in our Indigenous communities or other smaller towns across northern BC and other areas of BC. And we have to leverage those within the community, not necessarily with this background on the mental health side, and try to do the best we can do. But you know, it's factored into our training, and Toronto would be no different than the RCMP. We have de-escalation training, and we learn a lot about the dynamics of excited delirium, for example. So if we know we're going to a call and there's the individuals exhibiting the factors around excited delirium, we will reach out to the medical side if and when it's available to us. So not quite as easy when you're in a small town as compared to when you're in a larger metropolitan center.
And I guess, you know, to both of you, it's one of those things where, I mean, I would think, you know, if we don't have the police in on these calls that relate to mental health, addiction, overdoses, you know, I do think there is a level of danger and unpredictability there. And I don't think there's ever going to be a day where, you know, the police aren't going to be involved to assess that situation, because it, you know, I don't have to tell you both, you know, it doesn't take long for something to get out of hand or somebody to be unpredictable really, really quickly and escalate. And what's your take on that? Do you see, am I crazy there? Or is there, do I have a bit of a point there in terms of, is this ever going to be something the police isn't going to be involved with?
I actually think there's fantastic models that exist right now that don't involve the police. For example, there are a couple of models both in Canada and the US where you can take your loved one to a center, and very much like you would go to the hospital or to a walk-in clinic to deal with a medical issue, you would go to a center where you can walk in to get support when someone you love is in crisis.
Yeah.
And so the police are not involved at all. Similarly, our business association right in the heart of downtown Toronto hired social workers. And what they find is in that area, there are a lot of issues around mental health, homelessness, addiction. And what they'll do is send a social worker out to meet with someone rather than waiting for police to intervene and deal with it. And they'll actually marry that person up with community supports to get them what they need.
Now, do you feel that that would be on, I'm referring to more of an emergency basis where, you know, that's well and good if, you know, the person is, you know, say non-aggressive, non-combatant, they don't have a weapon, they're not unconscious, who knows how they're going to wake, when the unpredictability's out of that situation. But I'm talking more of, you know, someone's curled up on a ball, you know, shaking on a sidewalk, not knowing what's under a code, or they're in a position where people don't know what to expect. You know, those are the kind of emergency calls I guess I'm referring to, where I would find it hard pressed to believe that a social worker would want to take that risk, because they're not trained like the police to deal with these specific types of potential situations. So I guess that's kind of the more on the, you know, the emergency calls. So what's your take on the emergency side where it's more unpredictable?
Yeah, if it's life or death in terms of violence, then certainly police are always going to be involved.
Yeah.
Remember, though, that most calls regarding someone in crisis don't involve that. In fact, the level of, you know, committing an assault and that kind of thing in people who have mental health issues is actually lower than the general population, right?
Yeah.
And the circumstance you described with someone curled up on the sidewalk, I mean, paramedics deal with those kinds of calls without police all the time.
Yeah.
So you're right in that it's very specific regarding what the circumstances are in that case. I don't think you're going to see police come out of these situations, but I do think that there's some fantastic models out there right now that are different and that are working.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, I think that, you know, ultimately, the police are very busy with really, there's a lot of other calls that you're getting and a lot of other different things that should take priority. So I know there's probably a mix where there are sometimes, you know, in some situations where, you know, you definitely need to be there, but you're probably also brought in to deal with a lot of different situations that is an abuse of your time. Do you see a lot of calls where you really don't need to be there, but you kind of have to go? Is there a lack of other support that could be used? Do you feel that you're kind of pulled into situations that, you know, aren't really priority? per se?
Oh, I think police are the catch-all for everything, and this is the challenge. And that's why more training is always recommended. And training, of course, is very important. But every type of situation that people don't know how to deal with often falls onto us. Mm-hmm. The situation we're seeing with mental health right now, for example, has really occurred because of lack of funding of other services. So it has fallen down onto the police to deal with, and it's not always the best model.
Okay. So you talk a lot about models, and I think for both of you, I'd like to know, you know, what new models are you know, both departments coming up with, and what are you excited about to see in the future for law enforcement?
You know, I'll touch base on that because I think we're very fortunate in law enforcement. I think over the 32 years I've been working in this career, I'm really impressed with the amount of outward looking we do. You know, we were an insular occupation, if you want to call that 32 years ago, but there's a lot more understanding, whether that be academia or special interest groups or community partners or different groups throughout our communities, no matter how small or large they are, that we leverage in order to understand, are we doing well? I would add to that, anytime we do a call, and it's whether it's Toronto or RCMP or any other municipal police, where things don't go well, there's always a review. We try to learn from those opportunities, you know, and the training that's available now, I mentioned a bit of that in relation to de-escalation and a lot more information that's provided to us by health, mental health practitioners, pardon me. So, you know, we're talking about response here, but that's not all that value is that we get from those partners. It's a lot about understanding, you know, how to prepare ourselves going into a call, understanding our community, understanding what other stakeholders are available to us in the community to assist us. So there's been a huge amount of investiture to outward leaning relationships, and it's never enough. There's always more room for that. But I think that's taken our way of approaching, whether it be mental health or use of force or any other challenging issue that we deal with in law enforcement, to a different level.
Amazing.
Amazing.
Thank you both for those answers. And I think it's, you know, I obviously have, as I've mentioned to both of you, you know, I have a lot of friends, RCMP, Toronto Police, FBI, Department of Defense, and I hold, you know, you guys very dear. And I think, you know, you're a big, huge asset, you know, to the community, both of you ladies. And I'm going to take this down a different road. Two wonderful ladies who are high ranking officers. How was your journey when you started on the force to where you are now? And what messages do you have for aspiring ladies out there who are looking to climb in their verticals or maybe even within the police forces? I'll let whichever one of you want to take the... both are ready to go. I love it.
Yeah, I see Jennifer smiling and grinning.
Both, and I love it.
Well, I guess I'll start because I got to say there's a lot of... perspective around policing and how we're slow to move and evolve. And I got to say, the 32 years I'm in policing, and I don't look at just as the RCMP, because in Canada, we're very fortunate to have very close working relationships across all Canadian law enforcement through the Canadian Association of Chiefs of Police and the integrated work that we do. And I got to say, I'm sure Shauna will have her opinion. I got a little bit more service than Shauna does, but the career policing today, as compared to what it was when I joined, is completely different. And I'm where I sit in law enforcement, I'm very proud to be part of it. And I feel like when I got in my organization, we were about 12%. Now we're up to about 25% women in the organization. And just the ability to be, as I already mentioned, external facing versus constantly looking inside, we've brought a lot more civilian complement to our organization, and I think it's taken us to whole different levels. There's the allowing ourselves to be open to our community partners and oversight mechanisms again, and there's still more work to be done in that regard, but it modernizes policing. And for myself, as a, you know, I feel like I've been a change agent. I grew up with a mom who was a nurse in the 50s when, you know, nurses were women and doctors were men, and she really encouraged me in the 80s to do something different and not let the rhetoric or negativity around me keep me from doing what I want to do and to be a change agent. And I got to say, I'm very proud of where law enforcement is today because it really has evolved. And it's an exciting career to be in. I'm 32 years in. I still love coming to work because it's about people. And even in the tough times, like where we are right now, it's tough times, but that's where we, sometimes we expand our mind more and we do better work and we modernize. And I'm excited to be part of that.
Amazing. Shauna.
All right. Well, I agree as well in the sense that it's been such an exciting career. I always tell people it's a career like no other. Yeah. You have no idea what the next radio call is going to be. I've been able to move around every couple of years to different places and have completely different experiences. I mean, there's a reason that they make television shows about this career. Yeah. And what I would also say is women are really good at it. Women make amazing police officers. We were just talking about mental health, and it is the fastest rising call that we see in terms of numbers. Women are good at making connections. They are good at people. They are good at partnerships and working in community. They really understand complex relationships in terms of working with partners in a proactive way to prevent crime from occurring. So I do think it's a career like no other, and it's changed a lot. I can tell you when I joined, there were units that did not have women in it and in them, and you knew there was no point applying. It just wasn't going to occur. I saw some of that starting to change after a few years on the job. My career trajectory went a certain way, whereas most men's, it went a different way because I dealt with youth crime, child abuse, sex crimes, because that's where the opportunities were for women. And those opportunities are opening up. And what I would say to women joining the job is be you, because this is a job where you, when you bring your most authentic self to the table, when you bring you and who you are to the table, that is where you shine. And don't be afraid to speak your truth and to step forward and to lean into it. It's very exciting.
That's awesome.
Those are some amazing, great amazing messages. Words from both of you. And I would like to talk actually more about yourselves personally in terms of, you know, you covered a lot of types of crimes that you had to deal with. So, I mean, both of you being in the force for so long, how have you both dealt with your own mental health, especially going through, you know, dealing with so much? So my mother's is a nurse, and she, you know, she relies on you guys to, you know, also keep her protected when you do bring in people into Merge. She tells me about the things that she has to deal with that she gets at work.
Front line.
Yeah. And she has to leave them, you know, and sometimes it's hard to leave that part of the job because it's in your head for so long. And I would like to know your opinion from law enforcement. How do you deal with your own mental health? And when you go home at night, what do you do? What's your routine like from a day's hard day at work?
What a great question. It's a great question because we don't get asked it a lot inside. What I'm very open about is I've been to counseling for things I've seen on the job. And I encourage other, not just other officers, but other frontline workers to do the same. I can tell you that, you know, when I go to see officers after a major event, like the van attack, like what we experienced on the Danforth with the shooting, I tell people, you can go to counseling and you can struggle and you can get better and you can become a deputy chief of police. And it is something that everybody needs to be thinking about. You need to take care of yourself. Nobody questions going to see a doctor, right? Oh, I was in a foot pursuit and I twisted my ankle. Well, if a child dies in front of you, which has happened to me more than once, of course you should go and see someone and help yourself to figure out how to make sense of that. Because the things we see are very dark, and it's often not just one event, it's multiple events, one after the other. And it's having to go through these things on a regular basis that can make it quite difficult. So I'm all about getting professional support. We have dedicated psychologists in the Toronto Police Service, and we also have, as part of our benefits, the opportunity to get psychological counseling if you don't want to do it in-house and you want to go external. So, I'm all for it, and I've absolutely done it.
Yeah, I think really good comment, Shauna, and I think you would agree where the next generation coming along behind us are a lot more progressive in their thinking. Mm-hmm. I find for myself, you know, I work for about... 9,700 employees here in BC, and some of them are on the front line, some of them are not, and I have a responsibility to them. And I, when I go home at night, I worry about all my colleagues. And it's been interesting going through COVID, because I had a son at 44, so I'm trying to do math with him right now. I'm a later in life mom, so I'm trying to balance work, helping my husband with my son and math, which is not my forte. And then equally trying not to worry too much about my colleagues in the middle of sort of interesting times. But, you know, what I'm pretty And, you know, I have colleagues that reach out to me. I don't think I saw that at the beginning of my career. I mean, we did it on our watches. If, like Shauna said, if we went to a call and it was a rough call, we would have that conversation. I hate to say it, sometimes over a beverage, you know, 3:30 in the morning after a shift ended. Mm-hmm. But the new generation, and I think even some outside influence by, you know, Bell Let's Talk and other companies that really believe in investing in these conversations and getting rid of stigma, has done wonders for policing. I regularly have contact with colleagues who reach into me directly to say, listen, Jennifer, how are you doing? And they're folks that I work with, a particular sergeant and corporal that I'm thinking off the top of my head. And it's heartwarming to me that even though I'm responsible for all of these colleagues across the province, they're thoughtful and empathetic enough to reach out and check in on me. And I think that that evolution, and I talked earlier about some of the great changes I've seen, I have to say the mental health and working on stigma and taking care of ourselves has really improved a lot, and at all levels, and particularly with the new generation. I think they're doing an amazing job of changing that dialogue.
That's amazing. And it's funny because, you know, obviously, you know, we have both of you ladies on today, and I'm noticing our head of communications on our advisory board from the U.S. Army is a woman, Olivia Nunn, the command chief of the U.S. Air Force, Joanne Bass, former head of NASA for all of the human research project, it was Dr. Michelle Perchinok. You know, I'm seeing a huge growth, and I'm super happy to see it of women in power positions. And it has taken these companies and associations to the next level. It's a different way of thinking. It's outside of the box. It's a lot of times more empathetic, I believe. And, you know, I think it's fantastic. And, both of you are wonderful leaders, and you inspire people. And I hold you in high regard. And those are great tips. So anybody that's watching, that's looking to take yourself to the next level, and keep your mental health under wraps. Mm-hmm. The message here is don't be shy, use other people, use, psychologists, whatever you need to do to get stuff out. As an addict, I gave up drinking for the rest of society 2 years ago. And, that was a big part of my recovery is not being alone. And, I'm going to take the next turn here to talk about COVID, something that's very relevant, very real. How has COVID changed your lives in terms of how you operate, and what you foresee in the future changing through it? I would love to get your take. I'll start with you, Shauna.
So COVID's been the best of times and the worst of times in some ways. I think emotionally it's been very hard. It's been very hard on our communities. Mm-hmm. We can see the challenges that people are having, particularly around isolation. And again, the impact that has on mental health. Inside of policing, I think it's fascinating because as someone who's been involved in modernization, both on the task force, implementation, and as a deputy, so for several years, I've been involved in multiple very complicated modernization projects. COVID changed things so quickly in a really positive way. So we got rid of a lot of bureaucracy. We got a very complex initiative pushed out quickly. Everyone came together, figured out what we needed to do, and made it happen because crisis drives innovation. And that's exactly what happened with COVID. And so I think there's going to be some really interesting things that we keep once COVID is over in policing. So it's actually had this unintended consequence of creating some new opportunities in policing, which has been really fantastic.
It's actually funny because I'll quickly mention, as you know, as one of my other businesses with a couple of other partners is the PPE business. And I remember you had referred me over to Mike C, and I had the police coming to my door picking me up, and we donated some masks. Just from a sourcing point of view and opening the door for new providers to help be more, you know, for providers to be forced to be more efficient, cost effective. So just even from what I've seen from you and I've been on that that side together, and it's amazing to see that there's so many changes that pushes companies to be more competitive as well, which I think it obviously helps the end user, which is police, the community. So that's great. And I think, Jennifer, I'd like to get your take on COVID with the RCMP. How has the world turned over there?
Yeah, you know, I have to agree with Shauna. At the beginning of all this in mid-March, I was so worried about my frontline colleagues, because I think Canadians have to remember, while we collectively were listening to the advice of our healthcare specialists in each of our provinces or territories, people were still going to work. Not a lot. You'd been surprised the roads, even on the highway going through the Lower Mainland. I would get on the road after work and there would be hardly any cars, which is unusual here. And I'm sure Toronto was no different. So I think Canadians need to remember, through all this, we had the girls and guys who wear a uniform, despite the fact that they were fearful and weren't sure what this issue was that was in front of them, trying to follow health regulations and guidance. They were on the front line. So I really want to stress that. And they all have kids and families and elder care and everything else going on in their life. But tend to agree with Shauna is that it brought about some really interesting improvements. Like over the last couple months for us, we've had, other than our frontline, we've had about 56% of our colleagues working teleworking or working remotely. We increased our VPN capacity by about 500%, pardon me. And that also thought to benefit our Crown prosecutors, so that we could afford those that were in custody to go into some sort of a, you know, an electronic based court process to keep the prisoner safe, to keep the sheriff or law enforcement safe, and then equally the prosecutors and the judge. So really leveraging technology and demonstrating that our previous assumptions about, you know, working from home, we can't do it, it'll clog up the VPN system, et cetera, probably wasn't as forward-leaning as we should have been. And this is, I agree, Shauna, you're in crisis, you need to make things work. And I think it's going to lend to a healthier teleworking environment. And ironically, though, you know, you talk about employees coming into work and being able to interact with them and sense where they are in life. Are they not feeling well? Is there things going on at home? And that importance, particularly at the leadership and colleague level, to check in on people. Now, if you have, you know, a certain percent, say 30 to 40% of your workforce actually working from home, people being isolated, you know, how is those checks and balances going to work? But those are, you know, conversations we have, we adjust, and we move forward. So I think COVID, while being a difficult situation for all of us, created some really unique opportunities.
I didn't think about it, but crime, are we worried about, due to isolation, are we worried about a hike in crime, people's patience maybe not what they normally are? Is isolation taking a toll? Also, with borders being closed, is the drug supply down? Or what's both of your take on that? Shauna brought this up to me and kind of blew my mind. I never even thought about it. So Shauna, tell me what, let's kind of continue our potential.
So COVID has just, it's sort of changed some, the nature of crime in the city. I actually think we have not had the kind of, you know, looting and so forth that you've seen in other places. I just think it's Toronto the good, and our dynamic here socially is different, but crime has changed. So break and enters to residences are down because people are home.
Okay.
Break and enters into commercial premises are up because people are not there. Robberies on the street are up because we know that, you know, gangs are looking for money and there's opportunities there. And there's just not as many people out on the street. So there's a desperation factor. We've seen a rise in shootings. That's to do with the changing nature of gangs and how gangs make money and what that looks like in COVID. So just as businesses are struggling, so are gangs as they're figuring out what to do during COVID. And certainly you mentioned the drug supply. I know newspapers have done a couple of articles on this. And yeah, there's a change in the dynamic. Stuff that used to come across the border, whether it's drugs or other things that might be sold, can't get them. It's very interesting. It'll be interesting to see
that when everyone opens up
again what that looks like.
Yeah, because when we were speaking about that on the phone, I didn't even...
Never crossed my mind, neither.
I didn't think about it.
No, at all.
You know, and then domestics too.
Yeah.
People trapped at home with one another. I'd imagine spike.
I was going to touch on that. I'm sure that spiked.
My girlfriend
as well.
Yells at me when we're at work, let alone when we're trapped together.
So they were down and now they're up. And you're seeing a rise in it as people are self-isolating together for longer periods of time.
Okay. And Jennifer, how's it changed for RCMP? Yeah. I'm wondering on, I'm really curious about the, on some of the reserves, have you noticed? Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, I think our First Nation leaders have a very good connection, a majority of them, with their communities, and they have their checks and balances. And most of those communities will have community safety plans where we understand, you know, there's a, we have a reach in through our First Nation policing officer to the chief in some cases, or council members. But I would say I would agree with Sean, and I'm talking about an entire province now, but very similar statistics. Mm-hmm. I would add to that, you know, calls on the domestic side, violence in relationships, check on welfare, folks obviously in isolation, maybe not able to reach out to those that they need to, you know, with people being nervous about going to the hospital. And I have to give a lot of credit to the health authority here in British Columbia. They did an amazing job, but and they were out every day with messaging. And we have Dr. Bonnie Henry here in BC, and her team really thought this out well. So getting messaging out that, you know, if you need to get to the hospital, you need to go to the hospital. You shouldn't be putting your health second because of your fears for COVID, whatnot. So, but very similar, I would say, is just this sort of pullback in the property crime and an increase more on the domestic and check on welfare and violence and relationship side.
And wow. I guess the other question I had too, and I know we also touched on this throughout the last few weeks, but how are the officers doing? Are we talking about a lot of cases, a lot of testing, a lot of worry? How are the frontline officers doing in terms of how they feel about COVID and how much they're at risk?
So if I could share a couple of personal stories with you, I'm really proud of how our officers are doing, because whenever there's a big challenge like this, a big crisis, they come together. In fact, our sick time right now is low because people are coming into work and they want to be of service. They know that the community needs them. And so they're coming in. But the stresses around exposure, including the concern that they're going to go home and expose their families to COVID, has been very powerful. And I'll share a couple of examples with you. We have an officer who's living in a trailer in the back of one of our police facilities. And that's happening because they live with someone who's elderly at home and they don't want to risk exposure. I've spoken to wives and husbands who have not slept in the same room since the beginning of March over fear of exposure. Someone sent me a picture on Easter. I said, how was your Easter? Fantastic. I saw my family. Wow, that's wonderful. They sent me a photo of their spouse and their two kids on one side of a window at a table, and they're on the other side of the window because that's the only way that they can see their kids, because their two children have underlying conditions which might make them higher risk, and they just wanted to make sure that everybody's safe. So if you can imagine the emotional toll on not really being able to touch your family, hug your kids, sleep in the same room, those things that we take for granted, and yet with all of those stresses, people have just done such a fantastic job. They've really pulled together and come through during this difficult time. We just initiated testing, not just for us, but for police, fire, and ambulance, as well as family members if they want it. I actually just did it on Friday. I had my COVID test, and so we're encouraging members to go and get tested because it just helps also in knowing where you stand.
Absolutely. My mom, actually, she just got tested. She works at Mount Sinai.
I heard it's not pleasurable.
No, it's not.
I will say it's not as bad as I thought. It's not as bad as I thought, but it's...
That's good.
I heard it was similar to that. They thought I had meningitis one year, and they told me that test where it just goes as far back in your head as possible. I heard it's similar to that. So I've been kind of scared of even getting tested for it, to be honest with you. But I think it's important. And you know, I do sympathize because that, look, I mean, the elderly and people with underlying conditions and young kids, I mean, they are at risk. And when you're dealing with, you know, the masses out there, you know, it is a risk you're taking, especially since detection, I think, what is it, Sean, like 12 days or something after 14. You even get it? So it's not, right, 14, it's not even something that you can, that you would even know that you had.
Yeah, and Jennifer, how about the RCMP?
How's everything going? We had 9 positive tests thus far, and we've had a number of presumptive cases, and we were coming off spring break, so our colleagues were outstanding. If they had been abroad, they stayed home for those 2 weeks. And, you know, much like Sean is mentioning, you know, really keen to get back to the workplace and want to be of service to the public, despite the fact that we were all struggling with what this might look like going forward. We also have what we call liaison officers that are in different parts of the world. And those that were on the Western side, we took them out of country and brought them here to the Lower Mainland and put them in 2 weeks of isolation, them and their family members, to be particularly in those European or other countries that were seeing really high numbers of cases, to keep them safe. We struggled with wanting to give out health information, because usually in our, you know, we do have strict guidelines around what we can and can't say, but we put the needs of our colleagues around the what they were hearing in the news and their fears. We decided we would keep a really good comms approach to our colleagues across BC, so that they knew if a member had tested positive. We didn't necessarily get into where they were located, but that protocols for cleaning and ensuring that all colleagues and family members, et cetera, that surrounded that police officer were taken care of. We worked with BC Policing Services to get a bit of an emergency contact set up, so that any BC law enforcement officer, if they, you know, say they went to a call and this was happening where people would spit on our officers and tell them that they were sick and threatening the fact that they were COVID positive, that we could get some emergency testing set up. And we saw quite a few cases like that where, you know, if you're on a call and there's four or five officers and three of them get spit on and there's this worry, we wanted to take those five colleagues out and get them tested and not risk other colleagues potentially getting sick and, of course, family members and whatnot. So we went to great lengths and focused on sharing information to ensure our colleagues were up to date on how we were handling things and how our numbers were faring across British Columbia.
That's great. And just to be conscious of time, we do have to wrap up, but I was wondering, you know, is there any last words from these two badass ladies that we're speaking to? Is there anything you want to say to, you know, our viewers and everybody else that's listening out there?
Shauna, after you, my friend.
Well, I just want to say thank you for having us on the show. I think it's such a great opportunity to talk about all kinds of things that are happening right now in policing. I think a lot of people just aren't aware. And so the opportunity to just sit down and have an honest conversation like this on issues that matter is really important. So I just really appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I know that we're speaking with a lot of other individuals within the Toronto Police, and we're looking to tie as close as we can the Obie and Axe show to the Toronto Police Service. So we're working on many different cool things right now as we speak, obviously with your blessing, and you're obviously a great friend of the show. And as are you, Jennifer, and any word you'd like to share to the community watching?
Yeah, well, I have to say it's an honor to be able to do the show with Shauna. I had been posted in Ontario for a number of years and had the pleasure of working with her. She's a great leader from a great policing organization. So it's great to connect with her. I don't see her probably enough, but I got to say we're on the evolution of a huge focus on law enforcement. And I'm trying to talk to that next generation and say, don't let what you hear or what you think get in the way of making a difference in your community. And regardless of what stripe you choose to wear on your pants, whether it's Toronto, Vancouver Police, the RCMP, or any other great Canadian agency, is now's the time. Like, come in, make change, be part of that. You know, you can own what law enforcement's going to look at going forward. And that's the way I felt 32 years ago. And I got to say, I'm very proud. Is there still room for improvement? There's always room for improvement, but it's a great time. You know, COVID was interesting because if there's one thing I felt from COVID is people sat back and realized, you know what, I might lose my job. I might not be able to pay my mortgage. I'm struggling with how to pay my bills because I'm losing my job. But police, fire, and ambulance, we were all going to work. We'll always be working. And so I would just encourage young people, this is a great occupation. I love every day at the office. I love the people I work with and the communities I get to learn from and I get challenged by. So think about applying into law enforcement and be part of that change going forward.
Awesome. Thank you both so much, Jennifer Strachan, Shauna Cox, and thank you so much for joining us. I hold you in high regard, and we really appreciate you coming on the show.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.